But if you're a neighborhood hospital, you don't have a true reason for being in somewhere you're going to stack resources to try to do great, you end up being gobbled up by somebody else or extinct. So I think the great, great leaders sort of see, they understand there's things we need to do, and then we have to have a reason for being, a real purpose, someplace where we're going to be just absolutely fantastic.
We share the stories and insights of clinicians, healthcare leaders, and innovators who are improving the way clinicians work and deliver care. We've got a great episode for you today with Evidence Care's CEO, Bo Bartholomew, interviewing Scott Becker, the founder, publisher, and chief content officer of Becker's Healthcare, a leading healthcare media company. Scott hosts the highly ranked Becker's Healthcare podcast and Becker's Private Equity podcast, and is the author of several books, a regular speaker, business and healthcare trends, and a longtime partner at McGuire Woods. He's also an active investor in private equity and venture capital funds and companies. Bo and Scott have an incredible conversation on bringing entrepreneurship to large organizations, how clinical leaders can build great teams and avoid burnout, and innovative approaches to some of healthcare's biggest issues, such as physician shortages and rising costs. As you'll quickly be able to tell, Scott has an infectious way of presenting ideas with passion and enthusiasm, and anyone looking to improve their leadership skills in healthcare will get a ton out of this episode. Enjoy this conversation with Bo Bartholomew and Scott Becker.
Welcome, everybody, to the Better Care podcast. At Evidence Care, we wake up every day wanting to empower better care decisions for the clinicians all across the country who are taking care of our family, our loved ones, and patients every day. We're so grateful for them. Today, I've got a special guest, Scott Becker. We're going to let him tell you a little bit about his background. I know most folks know him as the founder and head of the Becker's Conference, his namesake, but also so much more. And Scott, I'm so glad to have you on board. And I apologize for being a little bit delayed. I was actually reading the Becker's news, literally, as we got started this morning. It's one of my routines every morning. So thank you all, you and your team, for putting that out.
Bo, thank you so much. You are a fantastic professional. We love what you do and thrilled to get to visit with you today on the Better Care podcast. A real pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. Scott, before we dive into any questions, tell a little bit about your background. I think most folks may not be aware that you're actually an attorney, and I've gotten to know you more and more over the years. I would call you an entrepreneur at heart, and probably the industry knows you as almost like a marketer extraordinaire. So tell us a little bit about your story before we jump into what's happening in healthcare.
No, thank you. So I've lived sort of two different career paths, and one ended up being accidental, but ended up being, of course, ultimately the core of my professional life. So yes, I'm a lawyer by background. It's obnoxious to say it, but graduated from Harvard Law School a long time ago, and it's a long time now. Early in my 20s, I started working at a law firm, and I won't tell you how long ago that was, but it's a while ago. Started working at a law firm, and the big message you learned as a young lawyer was you had much more control of your life if you were ultimately an entrepreneur within the law firm. You built your own client base, you built your own practice. So going back 30 plus years ago, I was working entirely in the healthcare area and started sort of a small newsletter, a small sort of like website. And this was before websites were a thing, in a small conference. And the idea was to build myself out as a thought leader, you know, it, what would be called today a thought leader, to sort of build a brand within law and build a legal practice. And so this goes back about 30 plus years ago. And at some point, I started to understand that what I was building in terms of a newsletter, a website, a conference, was actually potentially a business in its own end. And both the things were completely in healthcare. So my entire professional life, since about 27, 28, has been in the healthcare field, whether the law field, the media field, the business world, et cetera. And that's sort of how we evolved. And it was about 10 years into doing this newsletter, doing conferences, that I sort of looked up and got serious about pursuing that as a growth type of thing. You know, now we've got 100 plus employees. We've got a great leadership and editorial team. Jessica Cole joined me about 20 plus years ago, and that was a game changer in the business. She was one of these, like, sort of, she was literally in college and started working with me, and I had about 10 full-time employees at the time, and she just sort of outperformed everybody. And at some point pretty early on, we really put her in charge of everything, and that might have been the best business decision I ever made. And so we ended up living in the healthcare sector, really, you know, originally surgery centers, then orthopedics and spine, then hospitals and health systems about 20 plus years ago. And of course, as it turned out, hospitals and health systems ended up being by far the largest part of our business. And that was not, I didn't expect that, but that's where we ended up. And we grew, you know, largely hospitals and health systems, health IT, and other areas. We still have a whole bunch of what we consider legacy areas, but that are very important to our overall business. And it's been a great labor of love. It's been fantastic. And I get to visit with people like yourself, who are entrepreneurs, thinkers, operators. I mean, you're a fascinating person. And so it's been a great professional life. But that's sort of the background of Becker's Healthcare.
That's perfect. And Scott, recently you've actually released a new book. I've got mine here. I've got a lot of markup. I may read one of the quotes here in just a minute and get you to tell us about it. But tell us about what inspired you to write this latest book.
Sure. So I had written books in the healthcare business world literally 20 plus years ago, and that was a long time ago. More recently, it was an excuse to sort of collect a bunch of my business thoughts and investment thoughts in one place. Really, for the biggest purpose was to have them in one place. So I wanted to talk about an issue, talk about an area. I had it present with me and could talk to my children about it, whether it's on the investing side and trying to make sure that they become relatively conservative investors and not crazy investors. And then on the business side, trying to make sure I collect a lot of my thoughts in one place. And so then, to tell you the whole story in this, we did a first book of the predecessor to this about 2 years ago. And I was so busy with so many different things that I would grade that first book as, you know, a C minus D, something like that. The entire thing, and both these are self-published. These aren't through like the big, you know, professional publishing firms. This isn't, you know, one of the great publishers in the world saying, I need Scott Becker as an author. This is me. So the first one we did, self-published through a self-publisher, you know, wrote it all. It was a cluster of a process. The whole look of it was horrible. It reminds me of my first newsletter we did 30 years ago in the healthcare media business. It just was something that was embarrassing. So I didn't really send it out to anybody. It sold a few copies almost on its own, but it was sort of, and then of course, just because the nature of it was, once I'd written it and it was out, I couldn't leave that out there because it was really sort of, it did not reflect well on how I wanted to be reflected. I couldn't send it to people. I couldn't share it with people. And so over the last year or two, we then went through the effort of redoing it, rewriting it, reformatting it. We worked with another self-publisher. We worked with a colleague who would do some work with to help us sort of just clean it up, improve it, make it better. And again, the book now is still an A minus B plus. This is not Shakespeare, and it's not even good to grade a Jim Collins or something like that, but it's at least presentable and at least captures a lot of the individual thoughts I want to have in one place. If I wasn't so spread out with a million other things, I would put another 100 hours into it and refine it, which is what it needs to make it that much better. But ultimately, it presents well. It captures what I wanted to capture. The best moment in the book, the best moment in the book for me, because this brought me back to the purpose of it. My daughter had a bunch of her friends here, and they're in their mid-20s. And one of them asked the question about, and the young woman works at Bloomberg now, really bright young woman. They all went to University of Michigan. They're all smart young women, all professional women. And one of the women asks me, how would you think about initial investing, starting out as an investor in your 20s? And this was the moment I was waiting for, because I was able to then take the book off the shelf and show her the chapter on that. And of course, my children dismiss it, of course, as children do. But at least the young professional woman who's really smart was like, oh my God, that's so helpful. And she's like, who wrote this? Where's this? I'm like, I wrote this. You know, it was actually like, I couldn't have framed the moment better because it was in front of my daughter. It was with her friends. And one of them actually asked me about investing. I'm like, well, that was the purpose of the book, to have the thoughts in one place. It's, you know, you've gone through it. It's short. I love the short chapters. I love the concise chapters. It's imperfect. It's good, not great. I was reading a book recently, and Bo, one of the problems you have with me is once you get me started, I won't shut up. So just stop and put your hand up at any time.
I will. No, this is great. We love these stories.
So I'm reading Bob Parsons, who's the founder of GoDaddy and the founder of PXG Golf. I picked up his book in the airport. I was on a couple flights, and he's got this book called Fire in the Hole. And what Bob does, I mean, Bob's a billionaire and highly successful. And what he does in the book is much better than I do. He tells a story. And so you're following the story of his life, not just his business principles. And I would say that, like, one of my closest friends, who's very, very positive, who's great, was very positive about the book, but said it would be far better if you integrated more of your business story and the business story into it than you did. So it'd give it more flavor and more color. And so I'm a blocker and tackler by nature, and the book is a blocking and tackling book. But in reading Bob Parsons' book, I was like, I could see the light bulb going off as to what he meant and how that could be done and make it, you know, another level more interesting. So, you know, depending on energy and how many other things I'm trying to do, we'll do another edition of it in a year or so and try and do that in a better, deeper way. But a great project. That's the gist of where the project came from.
Yeah, that's great. And so as an entrepreneur who is also labeled oftentimes as a recovering hospital administrator, when healthcare executives, physician leaders listen to the Better Podcast, what is it that they could take away from your book in a book like this? I have my own ideas, but I want to get your thoughts.
Sure. You know, I come back to a lot of things are about everything that I've ever done successfully revolved first and foremost about building great teams of people. It almost goes back to a James Collins good to great theory that if you get the right people on the bus, you can figure out your strategy, do what you want to do. And I've seen so many people build effective businesses that way. Like, I see all this discussion today of the solopreneur, and that is not my perspective. Everything that I've built that has had any success, whether we built this fantastic group in the law firm, but it was built because numerous leaders evolved with me, side by side with me, and built a great firm. We've built a great franchise at Becker's Healthcare, and I can only say great because it's really Jess Cole and her team that are really running and driving it. So my core thought that everything is when people get caught up in the cult of themselves as opposed to building the team, then they end up missing the boat. And you can't, you know, there's so many old adages about this. You go fast by yourself, but if you really want to build something, you better build a team. And I just think as I start and look at everything, it all comes down to that. I'm not a believer, and we've all heard the Peter Drucker phrase, culture eats strategy for breakfast. And I don't really believe that either. I believe it's a combination. You need great teams and great purpose and strategy. You need both. And you need talented people. You can have the nicest people in the world, the best culture in the world. But I mean, look at the Chicago Bears. They seem very nice, but they're 5-12. But you better have like talented people too and a strategy to go with. But I start with building great teams.
Well, and you've got a chapter here labeled Two Secrets of Business Success. And the number two is people. A business needs a constant focus on developing, hiring, promoting, and working with great people. Over time, your business will not work, improve, or sustain growth unless you hire, retain, and grow great people. So I've got that underlined and starred right here. And it's absolutely true. And I think as we shift a little bit and start thinking about the business of healthcare and the hospitals that we serve, you can get into this. Hospitals are like a world in and of themselves, 24/7, always on. It's like a mini city. You've got finance, clinical, supply chain, pharmacy, outpatient. You've got all these constituents, and you could literally never leave the four walls of your system. And yet I believe, and I'd love for you to expand on this, Scott, that healthcare in general really needs that entrepreneur spirit. And I'm touching on your second goal of success, which is kind of that vision and goals of what things can be. And so talk to us a little bit about that, and then that'll pivot into kind of how do we begin to equip healthcare executives to really think about innovating in healthcare and bringing the new that's needed.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great question. And I sort of divide the role of a hospital leader into sort of two things. And this is where the vision sets them apart. Is the first thing is there are things as a hospital and health system, you know, all things being equal, that you need to do to take care of your community, to take care of the core population, to take care of what needs to be taken care of. I put that in the category of the 24/7 things that need to be done. The second thing that a hospital leader or executive has to do, it's the same in your business, my business, hospital leadership, is they need to figure out where they're going to be absolutely great and how they're going to be absolutely great. And so I look at sort of like Louis Shapiro, who ran for a very long time Hospital for Special Surgery, HSS in New York, now Brian Kelly. But what, you know, a long time ago, Hospital for Special Surgery said they're going to be absolutely the very best when it comes to orthopedic and musculoskeletal care. And then they've been ranked for 15 years in a row as the number one hospital in the world in that area by U.S. News and World Report. So, but the concept being there are things you need to do, take care of the whole patient. And then whatever system you are, you need to have a reason for being. You need to have a reason why people think to come to you for whatever it is. In the Chicago area, the Rush system tries to be a lot of things to all people, but it also knows it needs to be the very best in orthopedic care. It's constantly ranked in the top 10, top 5, 6 in the United States. They know at the end of the day, they better be great at that. That's the reason they stand out, in addition to serving their community and being a great academic medical center. And I think that's true, you know, whatever you're doing. It could be a, you know, as a neighborhood hospital, but if you're a neighborhood hospital, you don't have a true reason for being in somewhere you're going to stack resources to try to do great, you end up being gobbled up by somebody else or extinct. So I think the great, great leaders sort of see, they understand there's things we need to do, and then we have to have a reason for being, a real purpose, someplace where we're going to be just absolutely fantastic. And that's my perspective, not everybody's.
That's fantastic. And you interact with so many different leadership levels at all types of healthcare entities, especially health systems. Right now, a lot of chief medical officers and clinical leaders are often trying to bridge a gap from their patient care experience, frontline work, into kind of a leadership role. Why do you think clinicians are becoming more interested in kind of the business of healthcare? And what advice might you have to those types of folks looking to transition, so to speak, from very, very different roles, but trying to balance the two?
Yeah, no, I think it's a great question. I mean, we see tremendous physician leaders, tremendous nurse leaders, and we see them at every level of organizations. I mean, you've got people like nurse leaders like Jenny Spiso, who's the CEO of UCLA Health today. You've got Nancy Azey, who for the long term was a nurse and became CEO of Carilion Clinic, and both of them did magnificent leadership jobs. You've also got physicians across the country that are fantastic physician leaders. Howard Chrisman at Northwestern here, Dr. Lateef at Rush, and I'll just name a couple of Chicago ones that are close to mind. But the concept is, for so many physicians, I was on the phone yesterday with a physician who actually treated my own knee, so I know him really well. He, at some point, is moving towards a second career. He's already had this great career, been a leader amongst people, a leader amongst physicians, but has always been involved in leadership too, and now is taking on a bigger leadership role. And you see sort of, if you do one thing, you know, one of the things, Bo, you're an entrepreneur and have been involved in several different things. And you know, you need to have a core, the core thing you're doing great. But if you don't want to burn out, you better have a couple other interests. And so for so many physicians that we have worked with, who really have grinded for X amount of years as practicing physicians, at some point they start making that transition from being just a physician, quote unquote, to a physician and a leader, to a physician and involved in things. And I think most of us can't do one thing for 30, 40 years without, you know, burning out. In all of our careers, we have spots. there was a period of time in the law firm where you are working so hard serving clients. And at the time that you're serving clients, at some point you have to make the decision. You also want to develop business and be what's called a rainmaker in a law firm. And so for some period of years, and I think it's very apropos to physician leaders or nurse leaders, you end up with two full-time jobs. You're taking care of clients and you're also building a legal business, and they're two full-time jobs. They really are. I mean, the amount of effort I made to try and build a client base, grow a client base while practicing law was a war. And then we transitioned more and more into the media business, was sort of my next act. But I think for a physician, it's very similar. There's not that easy transition. For some period of time, you're probably doing some of both, leadership and clinician leadership. And over time, that might change and transform to more and more just being in leadership, which is a great calling too. Right? But I think it's so important for people. People want control of their lives. They want to have an impact. At some point, they burn out if they're doing the same thing every day. I mean, we say about practicing law, and clients are fantastic, but the practice of law, the joke used to be, and it's same in any field, is just like in your business or my business, God, this would be a lot easier if we didn't have customers, but customers are the reason for being. So you better have customers. But, you know, at some point, people get burned if they're not doing some multiple different things. And I think there was a period of time of extreme stress when you're making those transitions. But I think many people really want to do that.
I had an observation long time ago when I went to business school. We had a handful of physicians in the class, and I noticed that there was a lot of angst and struggle that they were having, and I thought they were the smartest people. I think they were the smartest people in the room. And my observation was this, and I'm overgeneralizing, so I apologize and give a disclaimer way ahead of time, but med school and the scientific method is typically following kind of a single train of thought and a formula down to its end. And optically, just kind of thinking about it, I feel like oftentimes business school and business in general is a little bit more like being a juggler, where nothing kind of fits linearly and you kind of bounce everything around until the right kind of things fit about 80%, never 100%, just so you can kind of get momentum. So I'm curious, Scott, if you've got kind of a similar observation and want to comment on any of that.
Yeah, no, Bo, I think that's brilliant. I think that's really right on. I think what happens is you see this, the difference in so many successful entrepreneurs is the ability to connect the dots, see the intersection. We see it in a huge percentage of physicians, no different than the rest of us, are built where they're able to connect dots, see those intersections, see where this tying to that can make a difference. So I don't think it's unique to anything, but it's the same thing. You see a CFOs, 25% of CFOs, and this is just a very rough number, are very sort of totally business aware of everything. It could be CEOs. 25% of physicians are totally business aware of everything and could be leaders. 25% of lawyers, the same thing. And those are very, very rough, but they sort of naturally see those connections and dots. Others could be trained to do so, could teach themselves to do so, and choose to learn to do so. But to a certain percentage of people, it tends to come naturally. And I don't think it's different for a ton of physicians that have been great business leaders, a ton of lawyers have been great business leaders, a ton of CPAs, accountants have been great business leaders, but there's a percentage that it's natural to, and others that really probably have to work at it, but all of us need to work at it. But I do think there's that linear education, absolutely true, but there's always been a percentage that see it in a different way, that connect those dots, see those intersections.
Yeah. Shifting gears a little bit, like I said, I kind of start my mornings off at the back of the news, and I try to keep a pulse on what's happening. But there's a lot of macro trends kind of hitting all of us right now. Workforce shortages, cost pressures, this new thing called AI that seems to be shaping or might shape or could shape healthcare today. For kind of clinical leaders and thought leaders in the health systems, what trends do you believe we need to really kind of keep a pulse on?
There's so many there. You talk about shortages. This is becoming a chasm and debacle where, you know, it's always been the case that to get to the right specialist, you sort of got to know somebody. now, even with knowing somebody, it's hard enough to get to the right specialist. And I use that, bear with me for a second, because I use that as an overview statement as to where we're at and where we've been at. But think about this. If you need to know somebody to get to the right person, think about how bad that is from a health equity standpoint for the rest of us. And the concept is we just have tremendous shortages. Those shortages are worse out of the top 10, 15 metro areas, because every physician and their spouse wants to go to the top 15 metro areas. I don't blame them at all. But you've got these tremendous shortages that are leading to hard to find the right physician, incredibly difficult to find a primary care physician. Many places in the country, you've got to get concierge help if you want to have a physician. You know, you just can't even get a primary care physician without paying somebody as a concierge. So that's sort of one. Two, the cost pressures are again going through the roof. Anybody who's renewed insurance this year had an aha moment. I mean, you know, in terms of the deductibles and the cost, you know, it used to be $18,000 a year was a really rich plan through a group plan. Now those numbers have gone through the roof. And $18,000 was a $12,000 insurance, $6,000 deductibles. You know, I went to pay for a medicine yesterday for one of the kids, and I was blown away. They're like, oh, you're pre-deductible. I was like, oh, got it. You know, but it's like the insurance costs, the costs are just going through the roof. Third, the insurance industry has been layered on top of everything. It's, you know, the medical care ratios are still about 85% or so. And that means 15% of everything's going to administrative cost. Medicare has become more than half Medicare Advantage. Providers are aghast at it. The rates for Medicare Advantage are going up per CMS. The rates for physicians are not. You know, it's the thing is sort of what we've got a shortage of is physicians and providers and so forth. We don't have a shortage of insurance companies. You know, I mean, you know, I don't want to bash the insurance companies. There's a lot of that going on. But in some ways, they're just an added tax to everything. And it's, you know, the political hierarchy has bought into the big insurance companies, or the insurance companies have bought into the big political hierarchy. But either way, it's a bit of a debacle in terms of where we're at. And we're more than 50% of healthcare is now governmental. Things that Republicans would have never said a generation ago is we might end up moving towards a single payer system and it might be okay. You know, because it just seems like the insurance companies have ended up being just a tax on everything. Not that it's an unpopular thought. It's just a real thought. Yeah, you know, it's an added tax to everything. And so harder to see the value that we're getting through the middle person there.
I'm learning stuff. I've been taking notes. You're amazing, Scott. This is a lot of fun.
Well, it's fun for me both. Thank you.
You've spent years speaking to kind of the top healthcare leaders and bringing politicians, thought leaders of all shapes and sizes together. What traits or habits do you see consistently in successful leaders?
Yeah, I'll go through two different things. I talked yesterday to a CEO of one of the great oncology systems in the country, and he's been at the same place for 30 years. And I always say about people that have been at the same place for 30 years, they better be likable and they better be competent. Those two things. Because if you're not competent, sooner or later people find out. Sooner or later people get rid of you. But you also better be likable. Because if you're someplace for 30 years and you piss too many people off, sooner or later somebody gets your scalp. You know, and so you better be competent and likable. With the politicians, the leaders, and so forth, one of the things I'm most struck by is the character in the media versus the real person. I'm going to say something and hopefully not offend half the audience here, but I would tend to have been over the years more of a Fox News watcher than an MSNBC watcher. And I don't mean to offend anybody, just where my perspective is on a lot of issues, not socially, but financially. And I don't think either party's hitting us right down the middle right now. But the point being, if you watched Fox News for years, you would have thought Hillary Clinton was the worst person in the world. You just like that was the perspective you heard on Fox News. So then, of course, I get the chance over the years to interview Hillary several times. And what happens, the character versus the person, Hillary could not be a more pleasant person to be around, could not be a nicer person, a warmer person, a more caring person, you know. And similarly with, if I look at George Bush was pilloried by the media for a very long time. what you find if you actually visit with George Bush, very normal, very smart, very common sense, and just an absolute pleasure to be with. So one of the things is most of these people that have gone that far are likable. They're actually really nice people. They might end up going into political wins with their parties at times, and it's very annoying, but it on either side, where they go too far one way or the other. But it is fascinating to me how likable they are, how smart they are, how largely they're good people. You know, some of them, of course, I've ended up liking more than others. I've had some of them when they feel like they're to be totally on message, and you just like feel it's the most annoying thing ever. Other times you're talking to a person. We've had Nikki Haley several times. And I love Nikki Haley, but we had a couple times where she felt like she had to be so on message, it was like talking to a robot. But when they're themselves and they're their authentic selves, you know, Hillary's the nicest person in the world. George Bush, one of my favorite people in the world. You know, I mean, just really, really nice, nice people, really smart. And the character on the media is so different than what you see in person over time. You know, and so I find that to be fascinating. I think it's probably the same with health system leaders. Most health system leaders, if they've survived running $30 billion systems, $2 billion systems, $500,000 systems, if they've done it for a long time, it's hard just to be a Machiavellian person. You better ultimately be a good leader because you can't recruit people and keep people. You know, one more thing, Bo, we used to say, is it better to be liked or respected? And if I went back 25 years ago, almost all of us in corporate America would have answered the question, far more important to be respected than liked. And what's happened over the last 25 years, now you have to be both. You got to be liked and respected because you can't keep and build teams unless people actually like, you don't have to be, you know, going to the keg party with them, but you have to be a likable person. You have to be a decent person to go with being a competent person. You don't have to socialize with people outside the office or to do any of that stuff. But you better be likable and competent. And I think it's true of most of the leaders that we get to visit with. And almost all of them understand, if you're on a $30 billion system, it's not you. I mean, you've done an unbelievable job moderating. We teach to our moderators, the goal is, in moderating, it's 10% the moderator, 90% the guest. And you've honored what we view as the core rule of moderating today, and I appreciate it greatly. And I've probably talked way too much. But it's similar with our leaders. They understand it's them plus their teams. It's them plus their teams and strategy. I mean, so anyways, that's all I got for you right now. I probably have said too much and you know, talked too much, but that's my sense, Bo.
Well, Scott, next time I'm back in Chicago, dinner, drinks on me. I want to thank you so much. I've got 100 more questions just personally that I want to pick your brain on and continue to work with. I've started buying more and more copies of your book for different folks to give to them. And we can't thank you enough for being a guest on the Better Care podcast. We hope all of our listeners will take something away. All of us need to continue to grow. I'm a firm believer. The greatest challenge our country faces is not the political division, not COVID, and not even these wars. It's the lack of real leadership. Showing up every day in organizations around this country. I think a lot of people have kind of hung the hat up. They're burnt out. And we need leaders more now than ever. And thank you for your contribution and raising up that next generation.
Bo, what a tremendous pleasure to be with you. Thank you and your team so much. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Better Care Podcast. To ensure you never miss an episode, we encourage you to subscribe to the podcast on your preferred platform. Additionally, your ratings and reviews are invaluable in helping us reach a wider audience. Please consider leaving a review, and if you do, email us a screenshot at marketing@evidence.care, and we'll send you a thank you gift. For access to exclusive content and further healthcare insights created by Evidence Care, please visit evidence.care/bettercarepodcast. And subscribe to our email list. We appreciate your support and look forward to connecting soon.